of the Larouche organization, Harald Schlanger in Potsdam, Germany. Former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter in Bethlehem, New York.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم بعضكم فوق بعض درجات لأبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإن لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return. So He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top story this hour. Iran urges Western states to defend the rights of Palestinians instead of denying the crimes committed by the apartheid regime of Israel. Multiple Palestinian casualties are reported in a fresh flare-up of violence as the Israeli military conducts a raid in the West Bank city of Nablus. Also coming up, a 34-year jail term handed to a Saudi woman for tweets the regime says have harmed national security. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has strongly criticized the Western governments for denying the realities that prove Israel is an apartheid regime. Nasser Kanani said official international documents and reports by human rights organizations prove that Israel is an apartheid regime. He added that Israel has been committing genocide, war crimes and crimes against humanity. Kanani urged the Western states to defend the human rights of Palestinians instead of denying the existing realities on Israel's crimes. His remarks came after Germany and Israel slammed Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's remarks on the occupying regime's crimes against Palestinians. During a recent visit to Germany, Abbas accused Israel of committing a Holocaust against the Palestinian people. German Chancellor called Abbas's remarks outrageous, while Israeli Prime Minister described them as a monstrous lie. Palestinians have submitted war crimes complaint against the Israeli regime to the International Criminal Court. The lawsuit by the International Center for Justice for Palestinians accuses Tel Aviv of unlawfully depriving Palestinians of property. It is filed on behalf of two families in the Gaza Strip and in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Al-Quds. It cites various examples in which the regime seized Palestinian lands and houses by force for its settlement activities or its separation wall. The complaint calls on the ICC to include the cases that it has submitted or intends to submit as part of a formal investigation. Israeli forces have killed another Palestinian youth. This happened during an attack by the regime's forces on the outskirts of the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. The 18-year-old Wasim Nasser Abu Khalifa succumbed to injuries he sustained after being hit by Israeli gunfire at Joseph's tomb east of Nablus. This came after Palestinian resistance fighters exchanged fire with Israeli forces during an incursion on the holy site. At least 70 Palestinians were wounded in the ensuing clashes, according to Palestinian media. Three Palestinians injured by the Israeli live fire are also in critical condition. Joining us from Ramallah is Mona Khandil to speak about the Israelis' violations and daily fresh raids on the Palestinians. Mona, over to you.
Well, for the Israeli settlers, the Joseph tomb or Yusuf tomb east of Nablus, northern the occupied West Bank, is considered very sacred for them. But it's inside the city of Nablus, inside the territory controlled or should be controlled by the Palestinian Authority. But despite this, the Israeli settlers continue to raid the area with the protection of the Israeli forces, of course. And during these raids and incursions, clashes take place, aggression continue to take place. The Israeli forces shoot at the Palestinians there. And this will continue to anger the people in that area. As usual, clashes took place between the Palestinian resistance fighter and Palestinian youths. This fighting between them and the Israeli soldiers and the settlers at the same time. It's not the first time a Palestinian young man is killed in that area near the Joseph Tomb. This time, 18-year-old Wasim Nasser Abu Khalifa. We are speaking about over 36 Palestinians had been wounded, in addition to some 30 others suffered suffocation due to inhaling tear gas. We have to remind our viewers that one of the Palestinian fighters had been killed, Ibrahim Nablusi, and he was accused by the Israeli forces for facing the Israeli settlers and the Israeli troops. He was shot dead by the Israelis last week for facing the Israeli forces who continue to raid the Joseph Tomb. So the Israelis want for the settlers to raid this area without even being faced, not being even fought by the Palestinian resistance groups. What happened today is another message to the Israelis that the Palestinian resistance would not stop their activities, and they will not allow the Israeli settlers to enter the Palestinian areas this easy.
Thanks for your updates, Mona. We will be sure to join you again in the next news bulletins to keep us updated on the situation in Palestine. Thank you very much, Mona. Moving on, a Saudi court has sentenced a woman to 34 years in prison over her Twitter activities, marking the longest jail term ever given to a rights activist. The woman, identified as Salma Al-Shaheb, has been charged with assisting dissidents who seek to disrupt public order and destabilize civil and national security. She's also been banned from traveling abroad for 34 years. Shahab had frequently tweeted about women's rights in the kingdom. The mother of two children, Shahab is a PhD candidate at Britain's University of Leeds. She was detained in January 2021 when she was visiting home for a vacation. The London-based rights group Al-Ghist has denounced the court ruling, saying it makes a mockery of Saudi Arabia's claims to reform for women and of the legal system. The sentence comes amid a harsh crackdown on rights activists, many of whom have been slapped with jail sentences and travel bans. Shahab's sentence can be appealed within 30 days at the kingdom's Supreme Court. China-US tensions continue to simmer over Taiwan. Now, a top American official says Washington will sell anywhere that international law allows, reaffirming transits through the Taiwan Strait. The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs also accused China of launching a pressure campaign against Taiwan. Daniel Crittenbrink said China has used a recent trip by the U.S. House Speaker to Taiwan as an excuse to change the status quo of the island and jeopardize peace. Remarks came after Beijing warned Washington against sailing through the Taiwan Strait, saying China will see such actions as an effort to support separatist groups in Taipei. Washington has no formal diplomatic relations with Taiwan, but repeated trips by American lawmakers have infuriated China, which considers the island as its own territory. The Russian embassy in the U.S. has warned that Washington's behavior on the world stage risks direct conflict between the nuclear states. This comes in the wake of the U.S. testing a nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missile amid escalating tensions over the Ukraine war. Washington had postponed the launch twice due to tensions with China over House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Washington is seemingly pushing the envelope with its latest military action, and this could lead to unpredictable results.
The U.S. has tested a long-range nuclear-capable ballistic missile named Minuteman III. Air Force officials said in a statement, the launch was not conducted as a result of world events, adding that they happen periodically to make sure the United States nuclear deterrent is reliable and accurate. However, the launch comes as geopolitical tensions rise across the globe. The test was originally scheduled in March, but was put off to avoid stoking tensions over Russia's February 24th attack on Ukraine. It was postponed a second time at the beginning of August as military tensions soared over China's test launches of multiple ballistic missiles and live fire exercises in reaction to the visit of the top U.S. lawmaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan. China considers the island to be a breakaway province, saying the visit is an example of interference in its internal affairs and has warned Washington about the serious repercussions. Meanwhile, Russia has slammed the U.S. nuclear policy, warning that Washington's behavior on the world stage risks direct conflict between the nuclear states. Moscow says Washington's reckless disregard for other countries' security and interests contributes to an increase in nuclear risks. In addition, Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused the U.S. of trying to prolong the conflict in Ukraine and provoke confrontations across the world. Putin says one such attempt was the recent visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan. He says the trip was part of what he called a purposeful, conscious strategy to destabilize the region. The Russian president called the visit a brazen demonstration of disrespect for the sovereignty of other countries. He also said Western countries are seeking to create a NATO-like military bloc in the Asia-Pacific. The Russian president also has said that Moscow values its ties with countries in Latin America, Asia, and Africa, and is ready to offer modern weapons to its allies. Putin said in February that his nation's nuclear forces should be put on high alert as U.S. moves raised fears of a nuclear war.
And what we're seeing now is a new arms race, which, of course, the Russian Federation doesn't want, but the United States keeps pursuing and keeps pushing ahead.
The message that Washington is sending by testing a nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missile amid ongoing tensions between the states and world powers is anything but friendly and could lead to unpredictable results.
The U.S. military says the latest missile test demonstrates the readiness of American nuclear forces and provides confidence in the lethality and effectiveness of the nation's nuclear deterrent. The fresh development once again brings to the fore Washington's double standards, especially when it comes to its opposition to Iran's civilian nuclear program.
The demonstration of America's nuclear power comes amid notable global issues such as Russia's war in Ukraine, as well as rising tensions between China and Taiwan. Therefore, it will only raise the possibility of conflict. That's why the U.S. claims to be preventing a nuclear fiasco. But the facts suggest the opposite. The U.S. has over 5,400 nuclear warheads. Also, Washington has recently withdrawn from two key arms control agreements. The 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which banned certain classes of land-based missiles, and the 1992 Treaty on Open Skies, which allowed for surveillance flights over each other's territories. In addition, the U.S. makes unfounded accusations against the countries whose worldviews do not coincide with the American ones. For instance, Iran. Throughout the years, Tehran has repeatedly reiterated that its nuclear program was for purely peaceful purposes, and that it had no interest in developing nuclear weapons in spite of the US-led commotion created over its nuclear program. But the US has leveled inhumane sanctions against Iran to dismantle the country's nuclear program, a goal that has never been realized.
I believe, first and foremost, that as many commentators have mentioned over the past few decades, that the United States is the number one rogue nation. And what we see here with the recent tests of the intercontinental ballistic missile in the past 24 hours by the United States Air Force is that the United States continues to pursue a path that is reckless, that is dangerous, that continues escalations and provocations not only against Russia, against China, against the Islamic Republic of Iran, against Cuba, Venezuela, against many countries.
Washington continues to stoke instability across the globe, and its actions show no sign of good faith. It's high time the U.S. stopped its belligerent moves in order to avoid further crises in the world.
Moving on to other news, UK inflation has risen to another 40-year high as spiralling food and energy prices continue to intensify a historic squeeze on households, otherwise known as the cost of living crisis. Saidpour Reza asks Londoners how they are coping with soaring prices amid a record pay slump.
The sizzling temperatures have cooled off in the UK, but the inflation rate is only heating up. Prices are going up everywhere, as inflation, this time driven by food price hikes, jumps to its highest level since 1982, coming in at more than 10%. Millions of families across Britain are now trying to make their money stretch, but it's getting harder by the day.
My weekly, my monthly, everything's shop is increasing. I'm shopping right now whilst I'm at work to just save time. Because not only is your time money, but we don't really have much of that thing called money.
I am having to budget myself, limit myself, to try and ensure that my wage lasts the whole month, considering I'm having to pay for petrol, bills, rent. It does all add up.
It's harder for me to afford things because, you know, I don't have the steady income like most people do in London.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect inflation storm caused by a number of factors. Brexit and the delays and disruptions it has caused to the supply chain, the pandemic, and the ongoing Western-backed war in Ukraine.
The UK economy reopened suddenly after COVID, creating bottlenecks at ports compounded by post-Brexit red tape, followed by astronomical energy prices resulting from a decision to wean the UK from Russian energy. Inside the UK, that has translated into higher transport and packaging costs, soaring energy and food prices. That means bills getting more and more expensive in supermarkets, restaurants, and gas stations, feeding the demand for higher pay, which adds further to business costs, which turns into even higher prices. And it is that demand for wage increases that's seen multiple public sector strikes in recent weeks. It's a worsening mess that some economists say is in large part the UK government's own doing.
The answer is the war in Ukraine. And you will say, well, is the war in Ukraine going to come to an end? And the answer is no, not if the UK government can help it. You see, Western foreign policy is involved in another debacle.
All this at a time when the UK awaits a new prime minister. Whoever they may be, they have their job cut out for them. Saipur Reza, London.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
In Britain, the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, is to call for a ban on crippling energy price rises this autumn, in a move that would save the average household more than £2,000 a year on gas and electricity bills, The Observer can reveal. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Observer's political editor, Toby Helm. The piece is titled, Keir Starmer demands ban on raising energy prices. In Britain, the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, is to call for a ban on crippling energy price rises this autumn, in a move that would save the average household more than £2,000 a year on gas and electricity bills, The Observer can reveal. the demand to freeze the energy price cap at the current £1,971 level, blocking the regulator Ofgem from allowing a huge anticipated rise to around £3,600 in October, will place intense pressure on the Tory leadership candidates Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak to follow suit when one becomes Prime Minister. Keir Starmer's plan to be announced on Monday comes as 70 of the country's biggest charities and organisations across health, mental health, education, care and other sectors today warned Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak in a joint letter of dire consequences throughout British society unless they take more drastic action to address the energy and the wider cost of living crises. Paul Kissack, the chief executive of the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, which coordinated the letter, said the UK faces a national emergency while the government is asleep at the wheel. Demanding urgent help for the most vulnerable in the form of a doubling of the £1,200 that was committed earlier this year to households on means-tested benefits, Paul Kissack said, without it, vulnerable people will face a catastrophe on a vast scale when winter sets in. The consequences of sitting idly by are unthinkable. Labour leader Keir Starmer, who returned from holiday at the end of last week, has come under pressure to say more on energy prices after former Labour leader Gordon Brown made the running with a series of major interventions. In The Observer last weekend, Gordon Brown called for an emergency budget. He has also demanded the freezing of the price cap, as well as the temporary nationalisation of energy companies which refuse to offer lower bills. In a pointed remark which some saw as a glancing reference to Keir Starmer, Gordon Brown wrote last week, "Time and tide wait for no one, neither do crises. They don't care holidays and politely hang fire." It is understood that Keir Starmer will call on the government to instruct Ofgem to freeze the cap on bills, saying it is within its power to do so. Senior sources said the choice for Labour had been between supporting huge amounts of extra cash help to the most vulnerable or preventing a massive autumn hike in energy prices happening at source. "It seemed best to stop the rise happening in the first place," said a senior insider. In response to rapidly rising wholesale prices, Ofgem warned in May that the cap would have to rise by around 40% to about £2,800 this October. Since then, forecasts have shot up, with analysts at Cornwall Insight last week predicting an increase of £3,582, more than 80% higher than the current limit. They also forecast further increases to £4,266 in the first quarter of 2023. New analysis for the Institute for Public Policy Research think tank, commissioned by the Economic Change Unit, finds that freezing the price cap would not only save families more than £2,000, but also help peg back inflation, preventing it from being embedded in the economy. The research says that if the cap were to be lifted to £3,600 as predicted, inflation would soar to around 13%. But if it were frozen at £1,917, inflation would be held back at 9.2%. Sarah Jane Clifton, Executive Director of the Economic Change Unit, said it was time for the government to act and make energy companies pay. Other countries have held down prices to protect the financial security of citizens. "There is absolutely no reason why our government can't do the same and shift the burden onto those profiteering from this crisis." The energy price cap, introduced in 2019, limits the maximum amount energy suppliers can charge for each unit of gas and electricity used. In their letter to Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, the 70 charities and other organisations, including the Joseph Rantree Foundation, Age UK, Trussell Trust, Children's Society, the Trade Union Council, TUC, Shelter, Macmillan Cancer Support, Mind, Oxfam, Great Britain and Action for Children tell the Tory leadership candidates that the cost of living crisis on low-income households is the gravest issue that our country currently faces. They add, so far this year, nearly three-quarters of low-income households receiving universal credit or other means-tested benefits, many of them working families, have been forced to go without at least one essential. This means people having to skip meals or not being able to heat their homes properly. Many of our organisations work directly with these families and are becoming overwhelmed, too often unable to provide the support which is so desperately needed. This situation cannot be allowed to continue. As the prospective leaders of this country, we urge you to act now to demonstrate the compassion and leadership needed to tackle this issue head-on. Isabel Hughes, Policy Engagement Manager at the Food Foundation, who also signed the letter, said, "Continuing price rises and the approach of winter will continue to make life harder for low-income families and those who have received proportionally less support so far are at particular risk. The government urgently needs to shield families from the worst impacts to protect children's health and their future." New polling for the Liberal Democrats, who also back a cap freeze, on Sunday, 14th of August, revealed that 7 out of 10 Tory voters back plans to cancel the October rise. The Liberal Democrat leader, Ed Davey, said the move should be funded through a tougher windfall tax on the energy giants making record profits. Labour said last night its plans to insulate more homes would save millions of British families more than £1,000. Ed Miliband, the Shadow Climate Change and Net Zero Secretary, said, "20 years of failure by the Conservatives to insulate our homes is one of the reasons bills are so high. Too many working people and pensioners live in drafty, cold homes with high heating costs. If they were serious about cutting bills, they could start right now by delivering the warm homes plan that the Labour Party has called for. A proper national mission would save 19 million families over £1,000 on bills and boost our energy security."
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
CIA in Indonesia.
Part 1.
The newly independent country is struggling in a deadly civil war. The rebels use a variety of armed weapons against the central government. They even enjoy an air force and aircraft bombing. It seems that the rebels are being supported by a powerful ally, an ally that is unknown to the Indonesian government and army. But on May the 18th, 1958, an incident takes place which reveals the reality behind this secret. One of the rebels' bombing aircraft is hit and falls. The pilot is found alive by the Indonesian army. Alan Pope, the pilot of the aircraft, is American. This news shocks everyone. What is on the mind of everyone is why America should be involved in overthrowing Indonesia's first government after its independence. Especially since Indonesia's government was in good terms with America.
The town of Bandung is an attractive place high up in the hills of Western Java. It's here that the Afro-Asian Conference is being held, and worldwide attention is drawn to the scene of this unique meeting. President Sukarno of Indonesia, arriving to attend one of the last sessions, evidently had quite a reception. Arab countries were among the 29 nations taking part in the discussions, and the talks covered a wide field.
Most countries attending the Afro-Asian Conference were fledgling states who had just gained their independence. The aim of the conference was to establish economic and cultural ties between Asia and Africa. It was in this conference that the initial idea of the Non-Aligned Movement came about, and it was established a few years later in the former Yugoslavia in 1961. The conference was in fact a message to the East and West blocs. The members of the conference suggested a world movement whose members could envision their future without the interference of Moscow or Washington.
It is a new departure in the history of the world that leaders of Asian and African peoples can meet together in their own countries to discuss and deliberate upon matters of common concern. Yes, there is diversity among us. Who denies it? But again, what harm is in diversity when there is unity in desire? This conference is not to oppose each other. It is a conference of brotherhood.
But it is interesting that all the efforts of Sukarno and fellow members of the conference were interpreted as communist tendencies by Washington. Only a few days after the Afro-Asian Conference, the White House ordered the CIA to be ready. This order was revealed 40 years after it was issued, and it was to punish Sukarno, or better yet, to overthrow him. The White House gave the authority to the CIA regarding Sukarno. It ranged from bribing the voters to supporting the opposition groups and even assassinating the Indonesian president. But what had prompted the White House to adopt such hostile measures against Sukarno? It seems that Indonesia's colonial past was to blame. From the 16th century, when the first Dutch ship reached the shores of Indonesia, till 1945, this country was a colony of the Dutch Empire. After World War II, many countries, including Indonesia, struggled to gain independence. In the 50s, Indonesia was the fifth most populated country in the world, with a population of 80 million. In 1927, Ahmed Sukarno, with his like-minded friends, established a pro-independence party, the Indonesian National Party, PNI, of which Sukarno was elected the first leader. Two years later, he was arrested and spent a year in prison. After his release, he was once again arrested in 1933 in Jakarta by Dutch police and sent to exile for almost 12 years. Sukarno was still in exile when the Japanese invaded the archipelago in 1942. 3 days after Japan's surrender in World War II, on the 18th of August 1945, Sukarno officially declared the basic governmental structure of the new Republic of Indonesia. After the end of World War II, the Dutch, with the help of the British, tried in vain to return to their centuries-old colony, but they were met with the defiance of the Indonesian people. In the end, the Dutch were forced to accept the independence of Indonesia.
In the Royal Palace at Amsterdam, the transfer of sovereignty creating a new independent republic, the United States of Indonesia, has been completed. Queen Juliana, attended by her ministers and in the presence of members of the States General, was the first to put her signature to the document. Mr. Mohammed Hatta, the Indonesian Prime Minister, signed the Act of Transfer and the Statute of the Netherlands-Indonesian Union. Mass meetings at many places in Java and Sumatra called upon the people to present a united front to the Dutch and their allies. And the claim has insistently been made that Indonesia has already established itself as a self-governing state. The leader of the movement, which, as I've said, is centered in Java, is Dr. Sukarno.
That is how Ahmad Sukarno was lovingly referred to by the people of Indonesia as the father of the nation. Sukarno, with his struggle for independence of Indonesia and also initiation of the non-aligned movement, showed the White House that he will not be a submissive leader in the Far East for the Americans. And worse still, he does not recognize the New World Order. But for the Americans, it was not too hard to find a pretext for hostility against Sukarno. The Indonesian Communist Party freely operated in the country. Sukarno had allowed the party to operate freely due to the fact that they had the right to do so under the democratic framework. This was at a time when a powerful trio was at the helm of the White House. Eisenhower, Allen Dulles, and John Foster Dulles. These three knew well how to eradicate any nationalist and independence movement under the pretext of fighting against communism. The Americans had discovered that Indonesia had 20 billion barrels of oil reserves. And a leader like Sukarno with such nationalist ideas would not allow American companies to get their hands on such a national treasure. They had to stop him on his tracks before it was too late. After visiting the United States, Sukarno visited the Soviet Union and China. And when the Americans declined to sell him weapons, he sought to buy them from East European countries. Yet Sukarno constantly endeavored to strike a balance between the army and political parties to maintain his country's stability. And the Communist Party was one of those political parties active in Indonesia. This was enough for the Americans to see the time and conditions right to overthrow Sukarno. A CIA operative in Indonesia informed his bosses that Sukarno insists on the involvement of the Indonesian Communist Party in the governance of the country. Sukarno's justification for this was that 6 million people voted for the party in the July 1957 elections, and the party held the third place of power in the country. Everything was ready for the communist phobia project to start. On the 30th of November the same year, a grenade was thrown at Sukarno in front of a school. He escaped the assassination attempt unharmed, but 10 people were killed and 48 children were injured. The CIA blamed the communist for the assassination, but later it was discovered that the assassination had no connections with the Communist Party. Finally, the Americans' project started. On the 1st of August, 1957, the CIA's report in the National Security Council created a commotion. Alan Dulles stated that Sukarno had reached a point of no return. And Frank Wisner, head of the CIA's Directorate of Plans, a clandestine intelligence unit, stated that it was time to hold Sukarno's feet over fire. Al Ulmer, chief of the Far East Division of the CIA's Directorate of Plans, believed that the rebels in Sumatra must be armed and organized so that they could take control in the capital city and put an end to the communists' gain of power. Very early in the case. According to CIA documents, on the 25th of September, President Eisenhower ordered Alan Dulles to carry out a coup in Indonesia. It only took 3 months to plan the operation in detail. A huge operation room was created in the southeast of Asia, and all top CIA figures were present there. They contacted some of the rebel leaders in Sumatra who called themselves Permesta. To carry out this operation, which was the CIA's most ambitious mission at that time, the U.S. Army trained and armed tens of thousands of Indonesian rebels. The U.S. Navy, which patrolled the waters of the Sumatra shoreline, unloaded telecommunication equipment on the beach. The U.S. Air Force provided hundreds of thousands of weapons, which were enough to arm 8,000 soldiers. And most importantly, 15 B-26 Invader aircraft were made ready for combat. Everything was prepared for the overthrow of Sukarno. On the 10th of February, Indonesian rebels declared their existence through a newly founded radio station supported by the CIA. The rebels gave a 5-day deadline for the Communist Party to be declared illegal and a new administration to take office.
First films of the civil war in Indonesia. Airborne forces of the central government are flown into Sumatra, the main island rebelling against the government of President Sukarno. Paratroopers hit the silk. Their target, rich American-operated oil fields seized by the rebels. At the same time, government troops move in by sea.
On the 21st of February, the Indonesian Navy destroyed the rebels' radio stations in the heartland of Sumatra and seized their positions in the shoreline. CIA officers and American mercenaries fled farther inland into the jungles of Sumatra. As the conditions worsened for the rebels, CIA commanders summoned their pilots to the Clark Air Base. Their aim was to help the rebels hit governmental targets and to provide military and logistic support to the rebels. The bombing started on the 19th of April, 1958. One of the CIA pilots that took part in this mission was Alan Lawrence Pope. He carried out his first mission in Indonesia on the 27th of April. In the next 3 weeks, he and his compatriots bombarded military and civilian targets in villages and ports across Indonesia. The U.S. Embassy's report on the bombings confirms that hundreds of civilians were killed in the attacks. In the final days of April, Sukarno's forces managed to completely defeat the Sumatra rebels, and in the midst of the conflict, 5 CIA officers who were in Sumatra fled to the jungles. Yet the aerial bombardment continued. In the early hours of Sunday, 18th of May, Alan Pope was carrying out a covert bombing mission in Indonesia. While flying over the Ambon Island sky, he sank an Indonesian Navy ship, bombed a marketplace, and destroyed a church. At this point, the B-26 Invader Pope was piloting was shot by anti-aircraft artillery, and the aircraft caught fire at 6,000 feet. Pope had his identification documents, his mission reports, and Clark Air Base pilot card in his pocket. These documents identified him as an American pilot. Pope jumped out of his aircraft with a parachute and was caught by Indonesian government forces. In the afternoon of the same day, a report was sent to CIA headquarters declaring Pope's disappearance. The next day, Alan Dulles sent a telegraph message to CIA operatives in the Philippines, Taiwan, and Singapore. Abort mission. Destroy the evidence and retreat. no one in Washington could have imagined that the operation would end the way it did.
In the limelight.
The House January 6th Committee and the Department of Justice continue to investigate Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election, an incitement of the deadly U.S. Capitol attack. Donald Trump is also under investigation in New York over his business and tax affairs, and in Georgia regarding attempts to overturn his defeat by Joe Biden. We're prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Source Says Trump Should Announce Run for 2024 Soon to Avoid Indictment. According to a senior source close to Donald Trump, if the former president wants to head off being indicted under the Espionage Act after the FBI search at Mar-a-Lago recently, he has to announce a campaign for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024 in the next 2 weeks. In communications reviewed by The Guardian, the source indicated Donald Trump needed to announce because politically it will be harder for the U.S. Department of Justice to indict a candidate for office than a former president out of the electoral running. A source also suggested Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump's only serious competitor in Republican polling, will not run in 2024 if Donald Trump chooses to enter the race. The source said of the Florida governor, he can wait. In contrast, a former White House official said Trump could yet decide not to run for fear of losing his grip on his party and role as a kingmaker should an indictment force him to drop out of the race. A search warrant unsealed on Friday, 12th of August, showed that the FBI seized from Mar-a-Lago 5 sets of top-secret documents, 3 sets of secret documents, and 3 sets of confidential documents, as well as other records. It was reported that some seized documents concerned nuclear weapons. Donald Trump called that report a hoax. The warrant also revealed Trump to be under investigation for possible violations of the Espionage Act, which dates from 1917 and has been used to go after whistleblowers. If charged and convicted, Donald Trump could face up to 20 years in federal prison or be barred from running for office. Trump denies wrongdoing, claiming he had the authority to declassify documents and that the FBI seized documents protected by attorney-client and executive privilege. But his legal jeopardy extends further. The House January 6th Committee and the Department of Justice continue to investigate Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 presidential election, an incitement of the deadly U.S. Capitol attack. Donald Trump is under investigation in New York over his business and tax affairs, and in Georgia regarding attempts to overturn his defeat by Joe Biden. On Monday, 15th of August, it was confirmed that Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York who became Donald Trump's personal attorney, is the target of a criminal investigation in Georgia over his role in the attempt to overturn the election. Also on Monday, 15th of August, a judge ruled that Lindsey Graham, a Trump ally and Republican senator from South Carolina, could not avoid testifying in the Georgia investigation. Having long teased a new White House run, Donald Trump seized on the FBI search at Mar-a-Lago for fundraising purposes, portraying it as an unprecedented raid and claiming mistreatment by political opponents. Senior Republicans echoed his claims, seemingly demonstrating Trump's continuing hold on the Republican Party. Recently, a Trump attorney, Alina Haba, said she thought Trump could end his legal troubles by announcing that he would not run for the presidency again. Alina Haba told Real America's Voice, "I've sat across from him. Every time he gets frustrated, I say to him, 'Mr. President, if you would like me to resolve all your litigation, you should announce that you are not running for office, and all of this will stop. That's what they want.'" But Alina Haba also said, "I hope he runs. I told him, this is going to actually increase your support in your base because they just always take it a little too far. The Democratic Party, they can't get out of their own way sometimes." Meanwhile, the FBI and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security have warned of an increase in the number of violent threats against federal agents following recent unprecedented search of former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida. Saying it has obtained the bulletin, CBS News reported on Sunday, 14th of August, in a joint intelligence bulletin issued on Friday, 12th of August, the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security warned that violent threats against federal law enforcement, judicial and government personnel